Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to our show, Empowering Family Caregivers. I am your host, Susan Bida, co-founder of eCareDiary.com. eCareDiary.com is a premier website on all issues related to caregiving and elder care. Our radio show, Empowering Family Caregivers, is just one example of our mission to help educate and offer helpful information to those caring for an aging loved one. Thank you for joining us today live from New York City. I am especially excited about today's show. Our special guest is Laurel Kennedy, who is the author of an impassioned and very provocative book on elder care and the role of women in caregiving. The book is called The Daughter Trap. Her book represents the collective wisdom of 200-plus caregiving daughters, what they wish they knew about elder care before taking it on, what they learned by doing it and wanted to share, the price they paid because of it, and what's on the horizon for the next wave of caregivers. Laurel is also the founder of a think tank called Age Lessons and has become an acknowledged authority on multi-generational issues and an advocate for mature consumers. Laurel, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Susan. I'm delighted to be here because we share that passion about helping people care for their elderly parents.
You know, Laurel, I agree with you, and I just read your book over the weekend, and I'm still in aftershock. Your book is a very sharp and explosive account of this silent phenomenon that we call elder care. I have a range of questions to ask you, but let's begin with what inspired you to write The Daughter Trap?
Well, actually, the genesis of The Daughter Trap was a personal experience, although the book, as you mentioned, is really the summary of more than 200 women who I interviewed. It was really that visceral experience, that overwhelming, always with you concern about how is my mom doing? How is my dad doing? How did the doctor's appointment go? You know, I need to remember to get her a different kind of slacks because it'll be easier for her to get into. You know, is my dad's medication still causing that inordinate amount of bruising? You know, is he still uneasy on his feet? And never ending, and it's always with you. And it happens to be, it's a blessing and a curse, and it never goes away until, unfortunately, they pass on. And it's never anticipated. I know, as a kid, I never thought about taking care of my parents as they aged. I mean, my parents were never going to age. And that's actually kind of a shock. Almost everyone I talked to had the same perception that one day you wake up and your parents are old and they need help.
Right. And you, in your book, you talk about that seismic shift that happens in your relationship with your parents. You know, they go from being your bedrock to now being the ones who are looking to you.
Right. Virtually every single person we talked to, although they articulated it perhaps using different words, was saying the same thing, and that is, the thing they like the least about caregiving is that it profoundly changed their role as a child, as a daughter. And instead of feeling like a daughter and looking at their parents as their parents, once they moved over into that caregiver role, they almost started a period of mourning because it was really the death of this profound, fundamental relationship that we all have with our parents.
Absolutely. Laurel, in your book, you don't hold anything back. You tell it like it is. And I'm glad you do, because the issue of elder care is much too dormant. And you say, for example, in the media, it just doesn't get the coverage it deserves, and it's a huge phenomenon. What exactly is the daughter trap? Why do you call it a trap, and why do we get caught in it?
We call it the trap because it kind of gets sprung on us. No one really asks for it. Very few of us are so wise that we can see 10 or 15 years down the road and know that this is going to happen. So the fact that it's a surprise, and the fact that people assume that we will do it because we're women, and women take care of business. You know, we see a need, we meet it. That's how we're acculturated, and that's what we do because we are more nurturing by nature, if you will. So it's a trap because we don't necessarily choose it. It really chooses us.
That's right. It does, oftentimes. And I also find it very interesting how you talk about the ways that we take on this role and the different concepts and philosophies behind them. I think you identify five different ones, and they're all very true. Can you tell us about a few of these?
Which exactly kind of principles are you talking about there?
The ones about, for example, you talk about the social exchange theory, and then the other one, which is the moral imperative theory.
Oh, right. There's different motivations that people kind of bring to the party, so to speak. Some people feel that it is their duty and obligation. Some people do it out of love. Some people do it automatically. I mean, they actually never challenge or question why they're getting there. But regardless of how you get into elder care, the whole purpose of the book is to say whatever you choose to do is the right thing for you, and that if you do choose to provide elder care, we want to give women permission to do it on their own terms, because one of the things that we see happening, and this I did experience firsthand, so I really relate to this one, is that parents are loath, as any adult is, to kind of cede power. So they often will ask for the help, but then they demand that it be given in their own terms without really understanding kind of all of the other demands and resource constraints that a woman may have, you know, between work and taking care of children and trying to maintain a relationship with their husband and the rest of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you actually talk about, and I found this part pretty fascinating, the way you talk about seniors going into this phase of denial, and also what you call, it's escaping me, but you talk about how they become narcissists.
Yes.
And tell us a little about that, because I think some of us who aren't yet there in the full throes of caring for our parents, I think, need to be prepared for this.
Yeah, it's a big surprise to almost all of us when suddenly our parents, who have always been these incredibly generous, caring, giving people, suddenly it's all about them. In one respect, it's very much like dealing with a child where their world is all about them and what they want. And one of the reasons, or some of the kind of social reasons that happens, is as people age, and we're talking about people kind of moving into the really what they call the old, you know, once you cross the threshold of 80, you know, your whole milieu changes, your whole environment. If you used to live in a home on a block where you've been for 20 years and you knew all of your neighbors, either your neighbors' kids have all grown up and then the families have moved away, or you need to move for physical reasons out of that home into maybe a more manageable condominium, a continuing care community, but a different kind of set. So it takes you out of this familiar environment. It also kind of truncates the number of people in your social tree, if you will. Whereas when you're young and you have children, you have all of the contacts, all of the people that your children bring you into contact with, in addition to everybody at work. When you're retired and let's say your partner has passed on, you're home alone, and you are really home alone in a much different sense than anyone else, because your friends are either immobile or they may have relocated to one of the more classic retirement areas like Arizona or Florida or Southern California. Or, you know, as I said, they may have passed on, so there's just fewer people who give you social contact, who open your eyes to the world. And older people are a little less, you know, they're a little more hesitant to try new things and to explore new things. They may not be physically capable. They may be concerned that they're not quite as intellectually agile. And for all those reasons, their social network becomes very narrow and the focus turns inward. And so that's why everything they do, everything they see, when they make a demand on a daughter, they're not really thinking about her situation. They're really just focused on their need.
Right. And this was very helpful to me, because I'm starting to see this with my own parents. You know, they were, you know, as parents, all their focus was on their children, and now
right.
as that they get older, it's the shift is really fascinating to see, is how they are really becoming very focused on themselves and to the detriment of the people around them who can help them. Let's turn to the third chapter. You don't paint a pretty picture of elder care, and you are very blunt about the realities. I'm very happy that you do this because the information is pretty staggering, and yet very few families do anything to prepare for elder care. Can you share some of this with our audience?
In terms of the experiences or how to prepare for it?
In terms of what happens and what happens when they don't prepare for it.
Right. Well, I mentioned earlier that it's a surprise.
Yeah.
Because the first kind of health incident, I mean, I didn't run crunch numbers on this, but just virtually everyone I spoke with and in my own personal experience, it kind of sneaks up on you in that your parent has a health event and you're like, oh, well, they're getting older, so, you know, if they have a fall, and they're okay, but, gee, that's kind of weird they fell. And then maybe the next year something else happens, and they have a surgery, and they seem a little slow in recovery. And maybe 6 months after that, there's something else. Maybe there's water. Maybe they have a congestive heart issue, and the water's built up, and it needs to be drained. And you start to see almost a chronic condition developing where it starts in the years and then it becomes the months, and pretty soon it's every couple of weeks your parents are either seeing a doctor or having a test done or having a procedure done, and all of that takes them out of a familiar environment and gives them kind of this mindset of frailty, if you will. So they go from being almost totally independent to relatively quickly being old,
right.
And it kind of happens before your eyes, but it sneaks up on you, and the fact that at first it doesn't hit you that you have just started down the continuum, it's just an event. And the second one, it's still just an event. The third or fourth time it happens, you start to realize, you know, there's something going on, it's happening more frequently, I'm noticing that they're having trouble with mobility, or whenever I go to visit, the TV's so cranked so loud that I can hear it from outside as I walk to the door, or the dishes aren't being, you know, instead of the dishes going right into the dishwasher after they clear the table, things are kind of piling up in the sink. There's all these really subtle clues, which, by the way, women pick up on almost immediately, and I have seen guys blow past these time and time again, and it never really penetrates. They don't seem to have that same sensitivity to environmental cues that women do. So it's usually a woman who's kind of the leading indicator or the one to pick up on the first warning signals. So what happens is you begin to modify how you interact with your parents. I mean, you suddenly become almost like I won't say policing, it's not like a police action, but you really start to kind of take inventory, if you will, every time you're over at their place. I mean,
right.
You start to see, is there hoarding activity going on?
Right.
You know, are the kind of housekeeping issues rising up? You might want to check their pills just to make sure that the right things are in the right days in those pill boxes that people take. And before you know it, instead of just going to see your parents once a week, once a month, whatever your normal schedule was, you are checking in with them daily, whether that's physically or over the phone, but you've got to have boots on the ground to make sure that everything's okay.
Exactly.
And what was just a social interaction with your parent suddenly has become very much a caregiving interaction. And actually, I was at a dinner last night, and somebody said, well, my sister and I shared the responsibility. And I wrote it all down one day, and I realized when I took my mom for 2 days a week, I spent over 19 hours just in different caregiving tasks, whether it was talking to the doctor or organizing her meds or doing her laundry or, you know, getting meals ready for her for the week and freezing them. I mean, she was astonished, and that was just in 2 days.
It's a reality check. And then add to that the financial components of this, which I think is pretty staggering. In one study, you talk about how the cost of elder care is about $309 billion a year. And then you talk about what the impact is on individuals. You want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, to give people kind of a top line on this, if your parent goes into assisted living, that's going to cost almost $39,000 a year. And if they're in a nursing home, that's more than $74,000 a year. And for in-home care, if you want, you know, almost virtually everyone you would talk to wants to live at home. And every study I've ever seen, if given a choice, people want what they call age in place, which means stay in their family home, whether that's a condominium or literally a house but wherever they've been comfortable for the last couple of decades. That will cost a minimum of $120,000 and an average of about $250,000. So, and these are after-tax dollars. This just means someone's got to find basically a really nice extra salary in order to supplement.
Oh, sure. And then the interesting reality about all of this is that a very few minority of people and families are actually preparing for these type of expenses, correct?
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things I'm a big advocate of now, all the things I wish I knew like 10 or 20 years ago, I'm a really big advocate of what I would call lifetime financial planning. I think the best wedding present that you can ever give a young couple is to sit down with the financial planner, and not just to plan for kids in college, but beyond that, to plan all the way through retirement. Because by the time, well, we heard all the numbers about how horrific Americans have been in terms of savings and what this boomer generation is really facing in terms of retirement and the rest of it. And the thing is, even if your parents, I mean, the elders of today are for the most part from what Tom Brokaw called, you know, the greatest generation. They were very frugal people. I mean, a lot of them have really nice nest eggs. The big flaw in their financial plan was that they didn't plan to live past 80. That was unheard of when they grew up, right? So their financial planners sat down and came up with a great program, which they may have executed perfectly. They may even have escaped the dot bomb in 2000 and 2001. They may have avoided the crash in 87. They may have even avoided the problems of the last 2 years in terms of investments and returns.
Right.
But nonetheless, they're outliving their plan by 10 to 15 years. So where does their supplemental living, you know, wage come from? And it's from their children.
I couldn't identify with that more because my grandfather, who's 92, was considered the millionaire next door. I mean, extremely frugal, saved every penny, and now he is ill with dementia. No one expected that he'd live into his 90s, and he's now living in a nursing home. And my family is now in conversation about what are we going to do when the money runs out. So it's a reality, and it's and I am with you in terms of advocating life. What do you call it, life?
I call it lifetime financial planning because I really see it, you know, all the way through retirement and basically taking you right up till they put you in the ground kind of thing.
Very smart. I'd like to actually switch focus a little bit. In your book, you talk about the daughter trap affecting everyone, and you actually devote a long chapter to daughter-in-laws. Can you tell us why you talk about daughter-in-laws? I mean, you really devote 30 pages to it, and what advice do you have for daughters-in-law out there who are listening?
Well, you're right, and I think the reason that the chapter ended up being so long is, one, it was such a surprise to me how many women end up caring for their in-laws. I was absolutely shocked. And the other thing that was surprising to me is how many of them have really good relationships with their in-laws. I mean,
yeah.
I guess I'm a victim of stereotypes as much as anybody, and I just assume that whole monster-in-law complex, and if you saw that movie with Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
I mean, it was hysterical. Okay, a little overdrawn, but, if you watch Dr. Phil, you've seen him on TV, that these women exist. And yet I talked to Professor Deborah Merrill from Clark University, and she had just completed a really interesting study where she would interview both the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law, and she found that actually people either really love or really hate their mother-in-law, and they really exist at these extremes. I mean, and we had so many people say, oh my gosh, you know, don't tell my mom, but my mother-in-law is the best. I love spending time with her. So when I heard that, I'm like, I think this really merits another look. The other thing is I was equally surprised to hear, and it was not the vast majority, but it was enough to take notice, the number of men who would invite either their father or mother to live with his family without consulting with his wife.
That was pretty amazing to me when I read that.
I know. I thought, you mean he came home one day and it wasn't, honey, I bought a new set of golf clubs? It was, honey, I asked my mom to move in with us? Oy, 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 right?
Right.
So that's why we developed the chart that's in that chapter that and it really applies for your own parents as well, but we called it a readiness assessment to kind of neutralize it so that a woman could walk through this with her husband and just kind of really put some discipline around the move. Because although emotionally you might really want to do it, it could just be literally physically impossible. I mean, and there's a lot of subtleties involved with having a senior move into the home that people may not consider if they haven't lived with one. For example, and this is getting a little scatological, but you might take 15 minutes to shower and get ready in the morning.
Right.
It takes a senior that long to just get in and get their clothes off to go to the bathroom.
Right.
So for them to get ready in the morning could be a one-hour ritual. Well, if you're already really squeezed for time, trying to get yourself off to work, your spouse, your kids, you know, you're squeaking by and you're 5 minutes late to the office every day, it just isn't going to work to try and get this person in there because they are rarely as vulnerable as they are in a bathroom because of the water and the slippery surfaces and the rest of it. So it's a real conundrum, and that's just one example of something people might think about. They might think, oh, yeah, we have an extra bathroom. But it will totally throw off kind of a household schedule. And then there's other things that you don't even think about when you visit someone in their own home because it's their home. But, you know, and this is a personal example, I don't happen to care much for fragrance. My attitude is as long as I want my house to smell like nothing, you know. I just want it to be clean and smell like air. I don't want fragrance around. Well, a lot of people really like fragrance. They might like really heavy fragrance, and you don't notice it because that's like your mother or your grandmother's kind of fragrance. But
right.
That aroma in your house,
yeah.
No way.
Exactly.
But again, it's something that doesn't even register with people. So the checklist will help them consider a lot of those issues, as well as the social dynamic. I mean, can they handle the noise level of your kids? If you have pets, do they like them that much? Would they allow them in the room? Would it bother them? Are they allergic if they have, you know, an extended exposure? Those kind of concerns.
It's a great list, Laurel. And I actually want to move on to the next chapter where you talk about men caregivers, which you call, I love the way you call this chapter, boy power. I'm actually proud to say that my own husband, John, is in that wonderful minority. He did all the nitty-gritty. He didn't just write the checks. He you know, toileted his dad, and he helped him bathe and do all those nitty-gritty things that you talk about. Tell us a little bit about men's role in caring for aging parents.
Men can be amazing caregivers, And one of the huge holes in kind of the social life of aging men is there's so few opportunities for them to interact with guys. I remember we were trying to convince my dad that it really was time, once my mother had passed, for him to move into a continuing care community. One of the big selling points is we're like, look, there's 232 men there. I mean, guys, buddies, you can hang out, you can watch the game together, you know, you can go to sports outings, you can just do guy stuff because there's just such an estrogen overload, again, as they age, because there are more elder women than men because, you know, we live longer. But for whatever reason, and I chalk a lot of it up to acculturation and a lot of it to the fact that as women, and I mentioned this, you know, at the really opening of our conversation here today, you know, we just do it, and we're not accustomed to asking for help. So the point of this chapter is to say, guys, you can do it, and when you step up, it is amazing. But the fact of the matter is, and a lot of people really have difficulty with this, 50% more women than men are caregivers to start with. But more than 70% of what I call the heavy lifting, like the things you just mentioned, like the bathing and the toileting and the less pleasant tasks, if you will, and the more intimate tasks of elder care are performed by women still to this day for no reason other than we just step up and do it because somebody does and because we don't ask for help.
You're absolutely right about that, and I'm glad that you devoted a chapter to men as caregivers because they do have tremendous potential to be just as helpful. We have about 6 minutes left, and I have some callers, I think, who want to ask you some questions, and I have actually a few more questions to ask you. Your book, I want to, you know, not forget to say this, is a tremendous call to action on several fronts. The family, the medical community, employers, and government policy. And I agree with you that we need a superhero, so-called, to lead the revolution in elder care. I think you used the comparison of Michael J. Fox and what he did for Parkinson's. That's what we need for, I think, the huge phenomena that we're facing in elder care. In your book, you point to some organizations who are out there who could easily champion this, but where are they? And I will point them out, the National Organization for Women and the National Alliance for Caregiving. Can you comment on this?
Boy, yeah, I think I actually, in one of the first chapters, really kind of take NOW to task, if you will, and I don't mince any words. I think caregiving is not even a secondary, but really like one of their tertiary goals, that even though 100% of people have parents, and that includes even test tube babies, if they didn't have parents, they wouldn't exist, it's 100% of their universe has parents and will deal with this issue, whether it's their own parents or in-laws. And yet, it's just a tertiary issue. They spend more time, more money, and more programming effort targeting really niche groups like the lesbian community. Certainly it's worthy, but they have their own niche organizations that do a great job of representing them. We need someone to really take control. I'm not sure how they got off track, in my opinion, from a goal like that, which, again, because it affects 100% of their population, certainly has to have as much merit. I mean, we're talking equal opportunity. We just said, you know, 70% of the heavy lifting is done by women. Where are the guys? If that isn't an opportunity for NOW, what is?
Right. Laurel, I would love to now turn to the section of your book that you call The Solution. And this really provides a wonderful overview of innovations that are in the works to improve the way we age. Can you touch on a few of these?
Well, one of my favorites?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm delighted to. One of my favorites is called a virtual village. The first one was Beacon Hill Village in Boston, Massachusetts. And it is this wonderful opportunity. If you live in an urban area, think of it as a zip code, that everyone over the age of, say, 50 in a zip code gets together and says, let's form a virtual village. We all live at home. But what we're going to do is come together as an organization. You pay a couple $100 into the kitty to become a member. If you're younger and you don't need the services yet, you can bank hours by running errands, picking up medication, you know, performing services for the older members. And then the older members get all of the services either for free as part of the membership fee or at a really deeply discounted rate that this collective, this corporation, if you will, goes out and purchases, and better than purchasing it. I mean, this was astonishing. The original Beacon Hill concept, they literally were able to monitor every single service delivery. So if there was any problem with a caregiver, a chef, a personal trainer, a cleaning person, they knew about it within 48 hours. I mean, that's astonishing, that kind of quality control. I think as they get larger, that frequency of checks or auditing will probably have to come down a little, but how amazing. And the other beauty of it is there's built-in social opportunities. If you're a volunteer, you spend your time visiting with other members, and if you're a member, you get to visit with one of the volunteers. It's awesome. And there's also kind of programmed outings and activities within it because they really recognize the fact that it's a real holistic approach. It's not just taking care of the body, and it's not just taking care of the home. It's really kind of food for the soul as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you talk about so many other solutions as well. We're out of time, but I think this is a great teaser for people to get your book and read, I think, all the innovations that are coming up, including technology and robotics and cameras that can be used in your parents' home as well. And also medical homes. So I'll leave that as a teaser. And what I'd like to do now is turn our questions over to a few callers, I believe. I don't know if we can get her on at the moment, but let's see. Hello? We may be experiencing some technical difficulties here, but in any case, yes. Oh, we do have our caller on.
Hey, Susan, this is Brenda Avadian of thecaregiversvoice.com. This was extraordinary. Thank you for doing this interview with Laurel Kennedy, the author of The Daughter Trap. I did a live tweet for the two of you this morning while you were doing the Blog Talk Radio. So,
oh, wonderful. Great. Thank you, Brenda.
I didn't have your, if you have a tweet address, I'll be happy to also add that in the blog so people can refer to your website and get further information.
Sure, it's at The Daughter Trap.
At The Daughter Trap, okay. Brenda,
thank you for calling in. Do you have a question for Laurel?
I actually did not. I just wanted to give both of you support for what you're doing. It's
thank
tremendous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your calling in. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Brenda.
Laurel, I want to thank you so very much for joining us today and for sharing your fascinating and your must-read book, The Daughter Trap. I'd like to also thank our audience for tuning in as well. Join us next Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For caregivers seeking help and information, visit www.ecarediary.com. And before I forget, Laurel, can you tell us the best place to buy your book?
I'd say the easiest place is Amazon.com. It's also at Barnes & Noble, Border, and all of the major bookstores.
Terrific. And we encourage you to register and access free tools on ecarediary.com. We also have Laurel's book on our shopping page as well, so that's another resource for her book. Thank you again, and join us next time on Monday, August 2nd at 2 o'clock. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Susan. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.